This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Following the killing of Breonna Taylor at the hands of police in Louisville last year, calls emerged across the country to ban what are commonly referred to as no-knock warrants. That's when an officer can enter a residence without indicating they're doing so or even announcing themselves beforehand. The city of Cincinnati recently moved to limit the practice. We'll spend the next hour looking at local police reform proposals and actions, starting with no-knock warrants, and later the quest to fully fund a key part of the collaborative agreement here in Cincinnati. We've got a big panel here to start the show. Joining Cincinnati Edition are Cincinnati Black United Front member Iris Rowley. Iris, welcome back to our show.
Thank you so very much for having me.
Cincinnati Assistant City Solicitor Mark Manning is with us. Welcome, Mark.
Hello. Good afternoon, Michael.
We have Ohio Justice and Policy Center Deputy Director Sasha Naiman. Sasha, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Cincinnati City Councilman and Council President Pro Tem Chris Seelbach. Councilman Seelbach, thank you for being with us.
Good to be here. It's a beautiful day.
Also with us is Police Chief Elliot Isaac. Chief Isaac, thanks for making some time for us. We appreciate it.
Michael, thank you for having me.
Well, Councilman, let me start with you because this was an issue that you were pushing for since last summer. We all, of course, recall the protests for racial justice that emerged all across the country, including here in Cincinnati, in the wake of more deaths of Black people at the hands of police. I want to know how you feel about the changes that were made to the no-knock warrant situation in Cincinnati. If you could explain what those changes were and whether it's what you wanted.
Yeah, so we started this process about a year ago after the death of Breonna Taylor in Louisville, which is where I'm originally from. And I said, what do we do in Cincinnati? Are we doing the same thing they did in Louisville, which led to her death? And if so, can we change that? And so we started having a discussion, and Iris said, well, hold on a second. Let's bring more people in. So we brought in the Ohio Justice and Policy Center, the Black Lawyers Association, a national organization, lots of people. And we had a pretty detailed discussion of the entire process of how no-knock warrants are granted by a judge, what you have to provide to the judge in order to get that no-knock warrant, and then how they're actually executed. And we said, look, can we figure out a better way to do this? Are there changes that we could make that would make it safer for everyone? Because not only did Breonna Taylor get killed, but an officer was also shot in that process. So, you know, there's lots of people who are at risk of these no-knock warrants, also neighbors. There's instances where kids were in a neighboring apartment and were shot because of a no-knock warrant. And so what we did was put together a motion that called for changes in disclosures to the application, listing the names, the number of individuals, approximate ages of the home prior to the raid. Includes the proposed action plan. So how are you going to, if no one answers the door within the allotted time, what are you going to do? Clarifies that they must identify themselves as law enforcement before entering the home. So several of these changes is what the motion called for. And then we met with the city administration, the police chief, and others, and they decided to implement almost all of our changes. So we announced about a month ago that almost all of our changes were implemented, and that's now the new policing policy.
Let's go to Police Chief Elliot Isaac. Chief Isaac, how important of a tool was a no-knock warrant to your department?
You know, a no-knock warrant is something that we did very rarely anyway. It's a very dangerous situation. You always want to knock and announce your presence. And we shared that concern as to what happened in Louisville, the loss of Breonna Taylor, such a tragic incident. And we certainly didn't want to see something like that happen here in Cincinnati. Many of these practices we had already executed at some level. I think just the opportunity to work in partnership with all of these great folks really made a difference, that we had a product here that we can really be proud of.
Let's bring back Cincinnati Black United Front member Iris Rowley. Iris, the councilman noted that you suggested to him to bring more voices to the table to discuss how to approach this issue. Would you talk a little bit about how that worked, how bringing people together to discuss this issue played out?
Sure, sure. It's the collaborative process. It's the process that we've been using for 20 years. And when you do it well and you ensure that everyone that can contribute to solving a problem, it's better. It's just a better fit, and it works well. So I called Councilman Seelbach, and I want to thank him publicly for accepting my phone call and ask if we could take a deeper dive, if we can join his already team that he had put together. And so we just brought in the community's wealth, Sasha Neiman. We had talked with Chief Isaac about it on some other calls that we have. And we just wanted to bring in the city and look at the entire policy where it could potentially have some issues. We took a look at some national standards. So we brought in Campaign Zero and got their thoughts around what we were doing. And so it is a perfect pot of soup in a storm. And so it is the process. And I want to thank Mark Manny for coming to the table. He and Sasha did a lot of work going back and forth over the policy. So I want to thank them both for what they have contributed to this.
As far as the end result, where we are here with the restrictions on no-knock warrants in the city, are you pleased with the result, Iris?
I am pleased. As you know, that this is an ever-evolving, ever-changing, continuously looking at policies and procedures to ensure that everyone is safe, that we can have policing in our communities as well as police accountability. And that is through the measures of policies, that is through ensuring that communities come to the tables and that their voices are heard, and whatever gifts and talents and strengths that they may suggest, that is part of what is putting together. So I'm okay with what we have. I was grateful that a lot of things were already put in place around no knock. So it wasn't that Cincinnati was having issues with no-knock warrants. It was what was happening outside of Cincinnati, which gave us the opportunity to look at our policy here. I think the chief lifted that up. So there were a lot of things that were already there. We still have some things that we need to nibble on a little bit and ensure that we got a tight consensus around what that policy looks like, the entire policy. But I'm grateful for what we have today.
Let's bring in Cincinnati Assistant City Solicitor Mark Manning. Mark, you were referenced there for your work on this project, in addition to another one of our guests, Ohio Justice and Policy Center Deputy Director Sasha Neiman. Mark, I'm reading a couple of different headlines from the Cincinnati Inquirer, our friend Cameron Knight, who wrote this, a friend of the show. In January, Cameron wrote about how Cincinnati City Council can't ban or restrict no-knock warrants, and he explains why. Earlier this month, he wrote another article with the headline, Cincinnati Restricts No-Knock Warrants. I understand that this was a power that lies with the city manager's office. Can you talk about the legal procedures on how you reviewed this and ultimately executed this new policy?
Sure, I'm happy to. So obviously, as I think the councilman and Iris both alluded to, this all, I think the larger conversation started with their, I think, official request, filing a motion back at the end of summer of 2020 to take a look at these procedures. And I think the initial request was to ban no-knock warrants entirely. And then that, I think, kind of got put on hold. And then there was a new motion introduced in January asking for more specific, more detailed changes that I think was the product of that conversation Iris was referencing with, contacting some other different interested groups about their perspective on these issues. But the interplay between council and the mayor under our charter is really one where the city manager is supposed to be the one who is in charge of the operation of the city administration, is in charge of discipline, is in charge of implementing policies and procedures for how our employees are supposed to behave. And so, that's the manager's role under the charter. And obviously council's role is to legislate, is to spend money to determine, that's, their biggest role is how to appropriate funds. And of course, the manager always wants to have input from the council, wants to take input from beyond the council as to what these issues are. So when this motion was introduced in January, I think obviously at the time, everyone, Councilman Seelbach can correct me if I'm wrong, kind of acknowledged like this is more a recommendation. We're asking you to consider the implementation of these as what we view as best practices. And so the city manager took those, obviously convened a discussion with the individuals, including the Black United Front, Ohio Justice and Policy Center, who helped create that motion, as well as Councilman Seelbach. as well as bringing in the experts within the city administration who execute, who draft warrants, and bringing in their expertise as to how they do that, so we could get their perspective as to how this should actually be done in practice and what the implications of any of these potential changes could be. And so by bringing together those diverse viewpoints, I think we did get to a point ultimately where we were more or less in agreement as to how things should proceed, or what different parts of the recommendations we could adopt. And as both, I think, the chief and Iris acknowledged, many of these were in place just as a matter of practice within the police department as to how they went through, you know, considering what are the risks when they're looking at the execution of a warrant, but really taking the further step of just not relying upon the fact that we have excellent individuals in these roles that perform these tasks, but putting it into actual written policy to make sure that it's ingrained more within the fabric of the organization, the Cincinnati Police Department.
That's Mark Manning, Cincinnati Assistant City Solicitor. We're also joined by Ohio Justice and Policy Center Deputy Director Sasha Naiman. Sasha, I understand that you helped work on this motion that sought to restrict no-knock warrants used by Cincinnati police. Talk about your organizations and your role in this process.
So the Ohio Justice and Policy Center is a nonprofit law firm, which is based in Cincinnati. We actually work statewide, and our goal is to promote fair, intelligent, redemptive criminal justice systems. So we do our work in all parts of the criminal legal system to make sure it's one of actual criminal justice. And when we came into this project to try to come up with a really great policy around no-knock warrants, and this is something that Iris had alluded to and the chief had said, we saw that in Cincinnati, you know, we did not have a case of the problem of no-knock warrants, in part because of really good practices. But we wanted to make sure we took on the responsibility of reviewing our policies, one, as Mark said, to ingrain things into the fabric of the policy, so it's not just relying on the individuals who are carrying it out, so that it's written out. But two, to look at the different policies that could impact forcible entries, that could impact warrants in general. And that's something I think that's really important to stress here, is that this went from looking just at the no-knock warrant policy to looking at all the things that went wrong in recent cases, like Breonna Taylor's case, which isn't just the no-knock piece, right? It's all of the different policies that could impact how somebody could forcibly enter a residence, how long they're doing surveillance in advance of getting a warrant. Pieces like that make everyone safer, not just in execution of one particular type of warrant, but in execution of all types of warrants.
Sasha, let me ask you, working in the field that you do, for the organization that you do, when Cincinnati is taking cues from other communities, we know that the idea or the understanding of no-knock warrants, primarily for many of us, emerged out of the tragedy in Louisville. Cincinnati had previously established its own reputation for setting precedent for the way to address needed police reforms. How does it work when your community here is looking elsewhere and trying to prevent what happened elsewhere? Is there a challenge in that?
It's a great combination of looking outward and looking inward. So we see a case that happened outside of Cincinnati, and that gives us the responsibility to review our policies so that we can avoid something like that happening before it happens here. But that coincides with us talking to community members about what is happening here. How is it happening? What are problems? What are opportunities for improvement? So the way that this policy evolved, the one that we're specifically talking about, actually illustrates that. We saw something happening outside of Cincinnati, and then through OJPC, by working with Iris and with Councilmember Seelbach and Chief Isaac, you know, we were able to talk to community members and say, what do you think about this? What do we need here? What is specific to our community? In fact, one of the things that we heard from our community was that we don't necessarily need a complete ban on all no-knock warrants ever, but we need some really nuanced thinking about the way that police enter into people's homes, about warrants in general, and about, for example, how no-knock warrants are used for drug cases. So we're able to combine those two pieces And actually, Chief Isaacs was kind enough to join Iris and I in one of these community conversations that we've been doing every Friday on Zoom about issues like this with local community members.
Let's go back to Mark Manning, the Cincinnati Assistant City Solicitor. Mark, did you rely on any type of learning from other communities in crafting what was ultimately executed here in Cincinnati?
I think a lot of what was beneficial about what Sasha and Iris and the council member brought to the perspective was they did look at some outside groups, including other law enforcement agencies, about what they were doing in this area. And I think that's something that's always useful for the Cincinnati Police Department to keep an eye on. And they are constantly in a process of really evaluating their policies and procedures and training and constantly updating those and keeping an eye out for national trends about how to best to do things. And so, like, I know that a lot of the way that both warrants and just in general and no-knock warrants in particular are executed here are the product of looking at how things are done on a national level, what are best practices. And that comes back to both, obviously, what folks like Iris and Sasha and Councilmember Seelbach bring to the table, as well as the training and experience and professionalism of like the SWAT commander and those individuals who are directly on the ground that who go to and who are constantly in a state of being aware of what the best way to do things actually are. What is the best way to keep the public safe, to keep officers safe, to minimize the risk of harm as much as possible. And essentially what is something that is in many ways just inherently a risky proposition when you look at, you know, headlines of how many, you know, officers are killed on an annual basis executing warrants, whether they're no-knock or just regular warrants.
That's Mark Manning, Cincinnati Assistant City Solicitor. We've also been joined by Ohio Justice and Policy Center Deputy Director Sasha Naaman. Mark and Sasha, I really appreciate you all taking some time to explain some of the crafting of the motion and what was ultimately executed here in Cincinnati. And thank you for being on Cincinnati Edition with us today.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Councilman Chris Seelbach, Police Chief Elliot Isaac, and Iris Rowley of the Cincinnati Black United Front will stick around with us as we transition our conversation towards the collaborative agreement and the quest to put more money into it to address a backlog of complaints against Cincinnati police officers. We'll later be joined by Gabe Davis, the Executive Director of the Citizen Complaint Authority. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Advocates of the Citizens Complaint Authority and the collaborative agreement between the community, the city, and the police department argue more money is needed to assist it in working through a backlog of complaints against Cincinnati police officers. We will be joined later in this broadcast by Citizens Complaint Authority Executive Director Gabe Davis. But now we continue with Cincinnati Black United Front member Iris Rowley, Cincinnati City Councilman and Council President Pro Tem Chris Seelbach, and Cincinnati Police Chief Elliot Isaac. Councilman, let me go to you first. I was following along on social media, a meeting at council, I believe it was last evening. Sometimes the days get a little blurry still, but I think it was last evening, where there were some heated conversations about the type of funding necessary for the CCA. Can you just give us an understanding of what the budget includes for it right now and what some advocates are arguing for and what the situation is?
Sure. So the charter calls for fully funding an executive director, five investigators, and an assistant. But we know that that's just not enough. Gabe can tell you the exact number. There's over 100 backlogged complaints filed that aren't being investigated because we don't have enough employees in the CCA. And so for years, they've been asking for more funding. And as we know, it's incredibly important. It's one of the major pieces of the collaborative agreement is the Citizens Complaint Authority. And when it's not funded to the ability for it to do its job, that's a major problem. And so Mr. Greg Landsman introduced funding yesterday to add more investigators to help navigate the backlog of cases. There was discussion, but ultimately a majority of the committee did approve the additional funding to hire the new investigators to help with the backlog.
Iris, let me ask you, I know you were present at this meeting, your feelings about the current proposal and the situation?
My feelings are, is that I'm glad that the council finally got to where they got yesterday. The Citizens Complaint Authority is the pillar of the collaborative agreement. And all that we're talking, whether we're talking no-knock warrants or Citizens Complaint Authority, problem solving, traffic stops, all of these things are under the purview of the CA. So it is critical that for communities to understand that the oversight agency have the sufficient funding that it needs to do what it's been chartered to do in Administrative Code 28, which is more than the investigations. They are critical. That is a huge part. But there are additions to that that we purposefully wrote into the charter so that the community, the city, and the police would have an opportunity to take a look at what is actually happening in real time, data, communications, the mediation that we've never been able to do inside of the Citizens Complaint Authority. It's critical to building better relationships and to further crafting this thing that we call community police relations. So I'm glad that they finally got there. It was heated conversation. I was extremely worried that we were nickeling and diming the Citizens Complaint Authority, and it should get what the executive director has laid out clearly for the entire city to see why we have this continuous need for sufficient funding for Citizens Complaint Authority.
Iris, when we hear about a backlog in the investigation process, what does that mean? What is the process typically? How long does it usually take the CCA to get to reviewing allegations submitted by citizens against police?
What's written inside of the charter is 90 days for a case that has been submitted that they have accepted that's under their scope. And so if it falls outside of that 90 days for the Cincinnati Black United Front and for the collaborative process, that then is a problem because it misses the opportunity. The Citizens Complaint Authority misses the opportunity to weigh in so that when discipline, if a complaint is sustained, so that discipline matches what has been sustained by the Citizens Complaint Authority. So that's problematic for us. And we want to be able to have a citizen-led oversight agency operate with all pistons firing, with every tool that was written in Administrative Code 28 to satisfy whether it is rightfully filed or wrongfully filed. This helps police, this helps community, and overall, it helps our entire city.
Cincinnati Police Chief Elliot Isaac is also with us via Zoom. Chief, we've had you on to talk before about issues in policing and reforms that are underway and just conversations about being a police officer in America today. Can you describe from your perspective the relationship of your department and the Citizen Complaint Authority?
Well, first, let me describe my personal relationship. I've long been an advocate of the Citizen Complaint Authority since the beginning. I spent a number of years working in our internal investigation section. And one of the things that I'm very proud of is that during my time as a captain, I commanded our internal investigations. And that was the period in which we became compliant with the DOJ oversight and the way we conducted our investigations and helped establish the current relationship we have with CCA. So I've been a long advocate of the process. I think it validates the work that our officers do. And at times when we do disagree, it gives us an opportunity to maybe take a deeper look at some of the work that we're doing. So I'm very supportive of the work that we're doing. And I know that over a period of time, through budget crunches and all of those things, staffing was lost and how that backlog was created. And I knew it would be very difficult to try to basically unbury themselves from what occurred over the last several years.
Chief, we know that all across the country and here in our community, there are ongoing conversations about the relationship between police and the community that they're tasked with serving. And where do you see something like an independent panel, like the Citizen Complaint Authority, fitting in a police department's goal of being transparent and approachable and accountable?
I personally feel this is very necessary. When you can have an independent body that does parallel investigations, and more often than not, you can come to the same conclusion, I think that gives reason for the community to have confidence in the work that the police are doing, and the fact that we can conduct ourselves in a fashion that is worthy of their confidence. So I'm very supportive of the process. Many departments across the country have looked toward our process and have established something very similar.
WVXU reporter Becca Costello reported earlier this month, quote, Cincinnati's Independent Police Oversight Board determined officers acted improperly in about 26% of allegations last year. The Citizen Complaint Authority's 2020 annual report includes 40 investigations involving more than 300 allegations. So we should note that 26% of allegations last year, the CCA determined officers acted improperly. And let's turn back to Councilman Chris Seelbach now. Does that number indicate this process is working, that there is an avenue for people to take their complaints, but there's also, I mean, 74% of those allegations were determined not to be improper, so there's also protection for police in it as well?
Absolutely. This is the Cincinnati Complaint Authority is not just about holding police accountable for wrongful actions. It's also about proving that they did the right thing. But it does say something that 26% of the time that they found that the police acted improperly. And we also have to talk about what that means. I mean, because the CCA doesn't have the ability to actually punish police officers. It's making recommendations. And I think we need to strengthen that relationship to ensure that there are penalties for officers who are found to have made mistakes. But yeah, I think this is just like the no-knock warrants. The CCA is about both protecting officers who do a good job and also holding the ones accountable who make mistakes and treat our citizens wrongly.
What processes could you implement as a member of the legislative body in the city government to establish some sort of way to strengthen penalties, if that's your perspective?
You know, I'm not for sure, because a lot of it has to do with the union contract, the FOP contract. And so it would have to go through that process. And as we know with no-knock warrants, the council does not have the ability to tell the police office department how to do their job. That's the city manager's role. But if there are ways that we can strengthen the penalties for areas where the CCA finds the officer made mistakes, I'd like to explore that. But I'm not sure, because of the FOP contract and because of the city manager's role, that we do actually have that legislative ability.
Let's bring back Iris Rowley from the Cincinnati Black United Front. I noted, Iris, 26% of the allegations last year, it was determined that officers had acted improperly, but that was compared to an average of less than 15% in the 3 years prior. So the numbers are going up. Is that an indication of more acts of impropriety among the police force, or is it growing awareness that this advisory board is out there for citizens to report to?
I think it's both and I think that Cincinnati is a very transit city, so people are in and out all the time. And you could see it glass half full or glass half empty. I see it as communities become more aware that this agency is there to file a complaint or to file a favorable comment about an officer. And you could see it as, too, in particular, in my community, the trust that anything will hold an officer accountable is still very low. We are just scratching the surface on this. You have to understand and you have to remember that there have been decades and decades of no accountability measures put in place to hold police accountable. So we have to continuously work harder to convince citizens And that is why we need to fund it and make sure that its sustainability is live and well. We need for the Citizens Complaint Authority to work its way out of a job. And that means that all citizens should be treated equally and fairly by the people that they pay to serve and protect them. So in my community, we talk all the time about the utilization of the Citizens Complaint Authority, because you see every day, Michael, in social media and all around us, where police are not held accountable. And certainly even in the city of Cincinnati. One case that we should all be aware of and should all make sure that we fight hard for the Citizens Complaint Authority is the Brandon Davis case. This case happened in 2019, 32-year-old man, has autism. He was teased 7 times. Knee was in the back. Citizens Complaint Authority didn't get to that case until last month. And there was no discipline for that, for those officers' actions. And even when the young man was taken to court, all charges were dismissed. Where is the balance? The balance lies inside of the Citizens Complaint Authority. So we need for it to be able to work fully, efficiently, and we need for it to be funded sufficiently so it can do that.
I do want to note we have a statement from the Fraternal Order of Police President Dan Hills regarding that case that you just mentioned, Brandon Davis, Iris, and FOP President Hills says that they're calling on the city manager to reject the Citizen Complaint Authority's, quote, blatant disregard for the facts in Ohio law. And he says, quote, Cincinnati police officers put their lives on the line every day to keep our community safe and reduce violence by investigating illegal activity in high crime areas. These officers followed policy and only used force after a suspect forced them to be physically resisting them. Iris, obviously you disagree with that.
Extremely. And I would ask that we all reject that perspective and that notion. It is clear that mistakes have been made, lives have been lost. And when these things do occur, you need the balance to ensure that, one, you can have policing and police accountability at the same time. We must make sure that our Citizens Complaint Authority is alive and well to do the things that it was chartered to do. I really am worried when I hear the FOP president say things like that, because this case, again, was outside of the time frame. The family did not get the closure that they needed. They did not get the respect that they should have gotten from the Citizens Complaint Authority because it was outside of the 90-day time frame. This is one of those cases where you want to make sure that you look at what happens so that it does not happen again. And yes, I reject everything that Dan Hills had to say.
Chief Isaac, I know we're short on time here. I've got about a minute left. I just want to ask you for any last thoughts on this. If there are community members worried about whether police officers are held accountable when there are proven allegations of improper behavior.
You know, I think that is the process. And the one thing that I will offer, you know, for the early part of that conversation is when it comes to discipline, that's the job of the city manager and myself. When she or whoever holds that position supports either the findings from our internal or from CCA, And if there's a recommendation as to discipline, that's the role that we serve. So I think that there should be absolute confidence when it's necessary for discipline to be rendered, that it's actually done in a fair and equitable way.
That's Police Chief Elliot Isaac here in Cincinnati. We've also been joined by Cincinnati City Councilman and Council President Pro Tem Chris Seelbach and Cincinnati Black United Front member Iris Rowley. Thanks to all three of you for spending so much of your early afternoon with us. We do appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue our conversation now about the Citizen Complaint Authority and the collaborative agreement that led to its creation and its quest for more funding. Executive Director Gabe Davis is with us now. Gabe, thank you for being with us.
Michael, thanks for having me. Good to be here.
How long have you been on the job now?
So I started back in September, so it hasn't quite been a year, but it's been close.
Yeah, so talk a little bit about what you've learned since assuming this role.
Absolutely. You know, leading the CCA at this pivotal time in the country's history and the history of our city, it's a real privilege to do that, to take on this mantle. You know, what I've learned is that we have a terrific police department that works very, very hard to police our streets, to keep us all safe. But certainly we understand that there are times when mistakes are made, there are times when policies are violated, and there are times when citizens have been mistreated, and there ought to be a place for them to come to have those issues vetted, to have those things investigated, and to have the truth come out. And so we play that pivotal role of ensuring that investigations into citizen complaints are handled fairly in an unbiased fashion. And that at the end of the day, that if things were done that were improper, that we speak that truth. And that if officers have done nothing wrong, that we speak that truth as well. And it's a real privilege to be able to play that role given the issues that are confronting citizens and police as they pertain to trust in our communities.
We've heard of the reported backlog of complaints that need to be investigated by the Citizen Complaint Authority. Can you quantify that for us who are not involved? Like how many and what does it mean to have a backlog of them?
Sure. So it's a requirement in the law in Article 28 that we complete our investigations within 90 days. And from our perspective, any case that is older than 90 days is a backlogged case. So currently we have a little over 120 cases that are older than 90 days. In some cases, we have cases on our docket that are 2 years old that are still from the year 2019. That's when these incidents occurred in those cases. And so that presents a problem. It presents a challenge for a whole host of reasons. But that 120 number is certainly the size and the scope of what we're confronting here.
And so that's why you are suggesting that you need to have more investigators looking into these things.
Yes, it was quite clear to me when I took this job and I looked at the numbers. I looked at our output in years past and looked at how many new cases we tend to get on a monthly basis, that the current number of investigators was not going to allow us to dig ourselves out of this hole any time in the next year or so, I'd say. In fact, our projections were showing that it would likely not be until 2024 that we would resolve all those cases. So it wouldn't be until 2024 when we no longer had cases that were 90 days out of compliance. So it was critically important for us to reduce that backlog before then and to bring ourselves as an agency into compliance with the law, but also to give people some basic fairness and to do that before 2024 and to give them the assurance that their case wouldn't take 2 years to be heard by the Citizen Complaint Authority.
Are these investigators, are they compensated? Is this some sort of full-time position?
It is. This is a full-time position. These are paid professionals. And when I started the job, we had some additional funding at that point in time to bring our numbers up from 3 investigators to 5. And 5 is the minimum number that we need under the law. It's not the maximum, but the law does call for a minimum of 5. So we hired those 5 folks, and they have professional backgrounds in the area of investigations. One of them is a former NYPD detective. One's a former counterintelligence agent and investigator with one of our U.S. intelligence agencies. And one of them is a former prosecutor, just to give you an example. So these are professional folks, but they're paid and they do a professional job of investigating the allegations that are brought before us.
Okay, so we talked in the previous segment about the Citizen Complaint Authority determining that in 26% of the more than 300 allegations received in 2020, that there were determinations that officers acted improperly. And that was higher than the average of less than 15% in the 3 years prior. Can you give us an indication of what your understanding of that is? I know you were only involved there in the last quarter of 2020, but why the increase?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. What we certainly have seen in the numbers is that there was a bit of an increase there. If you look at 2019, for instance, we sustained on about 20% of the allegations brought before us. And then, as you mentioned, that went up to 26% for the year 2020. And if you compare that 26% to the 3-year period before then, which is kind of before the pandemic, when things were a little bit more normal, so to speak, what you see is that those were hovering around 14% or so for that prior 3-year period. So we have increased in 2020 over that prior 3-year period. We've increased by about 75% to get us to where we currently are with having about 1 in 4 complaints being sustained, or 1 in 4 allegations, excuse me, that are made against officers being sustained. And, you know, there are a number of factors that might be contributing to that. We have not done a deep dive into the data to really understand and unpack what all those dynamics might be. So we can't rule anything in or rule anything out. But certainly as director, what my job is, what my directive is to my staff, is to follow the facts wherever they lead. And what that means is that if there are violations of policy that occurred, we're going to find out. And we're going to speak the truth, as I stated, about those things and make it clear. And if there are no violations, then we're going to say that as well. But certainly our job is to pursue the complaints, take them very seriously, and see where those facts lead us. And that's what we've done.
We're talking with Gabe Davis, Executive Director of the Citizen Complaint Authority. That's Cincinnati's Independent Police Oversight Board. Some of these allegations, can you give us an idea of what they are? I know that Iris Rowley in our previous segment specifically cited a case involving a man named Brandon Davis who had been tased. I'm sure they're not all violent like that. I mean, what type, do they run the gamut really of allegations of improper conduct?
Absolutely. That's important to understand is that we see all types of allegations. Certainly in 2020, the cases that we opened, the new cases, so to speak, contained allegations like excessive force. We also saw allegations of improper searches and seizures, allegations of discourtesy, allegations of discrimination. So we see quite a bit. We also see allegations involving improper procedure. And a number of our findings at times have to do with procedure violations as well, where for instance, officers may not wear a body camera, may not turn the camera on as they're supposed to, or may not complete certain paperwork that's essential to document citizen interactions. So those are things that we also take note of and things that we also enter findings pertaining to those sorts of situations. So we see an awful lot of allegations and various types of conduct in our investigations.
Do you expect to be fully funded in your estimation of what you determine to be fully funded?
Well, you know, at the end of the day, the funding for the Citizen Complaint Authority is really up to the City Council, and we certainly will be watching along with others to see where the numbers shake out. But, you know, we submitted a request a few months back for an increase in funding to allow us to hire 3 new investigators and to hire some support staff members as well to assist with other non-investigatory duties. And we're always extremely grateful for the support we've gotten from City Council, and we continue to be grateful for the support that's given to us and that we expect to receive. And we'll have to just kind of wait and see where the numbers shake out at the end of the day.
There was civil unrest in Cincinnati 20 years ago related to the killing of Black men at the hands of police that led to the collaborative agreement, which led to the Citizen Complaint Authority. I'm wondering if 2 decades later, based on what transpired across the country last year in these protests for racial justice, are the stakes somehow higher now for the CCA to be effective and for police to be held accountable?
You know, that's a great question. I think in many respects, whenever you're talking about the kind of allegations that CCA investigates, whether they're excessive force or we also investigate shootings, for instance, even if there's been no citizen complaint, those stakes are always incredibly high. And whenever someone alleges that they have been met with contact that in some sense was harmful and inappropriate, or whenever there's been a loss of life, for instance, as typically the case or can be the case with some of the shootings we look at, those stakes are always incredibly high. And so we've taken our obligation seriously for the past 20 years, roughly, of being in existence here to follow those facts wherever they lead and to take complaints incredibly seriously and to make sure that at the end of the day that we're speaking that truth, whatever it is, and that we're doing so honestly and incredibly.
I want to talk, or I guess I want you to talk about the role that the CCA plays in the relationship between the police department and the African American community in Cincinnati, because of the 265 people who submitted complaints to the Citizen Complaint Authority last year, according to Becca Costello here at WVXU, 57% of them were Black, and that's an overrepresentation of the city's 42% Black population.
Sure. You know, I think we're always aware of disparities that exist, and I think what our job is to investigate the cases, to present the data and the information, and hopefully at the end of the day, the information that we present in our investigations and those conclusions will lead to accountability, but also will lead to increased trust. And that really is what we try to do is to look to see, you know, how can we enhance transparency in this community, and how can we ensure that citizens have a voice and that people have a place they can come to bring issues? And also, how can we ensure that the officers who are being investigated receive fairness? And I think our numbers speak to our approach in that respect is given that majority of our findings do not result in police misconduct or do not find that. So we try to speak from the standpoint of of bringing accountability, but transparency as well, and hope at the end of the day that that helps to improve some of these relationships in our community between police and between community.
What about the relationship between the CCA and the police department? As you just noted, the overwhelming majority of these cases end up in being characterized as exoneration or unfounded by the CCA from the complaints that are reviewed against these police officers. We did hear some comments from Dan Hills, the FOP president here in Cincinnati, that were pretty harsh towards the CCA's findings in a very specific case. Not unusual to hear complaints from Dan Hills about the citizen complaint authority or proposed reforms. But I'm wondering, what's the relationship in your estimation between the CCA and the police department, or even the police union as well?
Yeah, I think we have a great relationship with the police department, and I respect and applaud Chief Isaac for his leadership on these issues. And we have an open line of communication, and we have a true partner in this larger project of improving police community relations. And that's very valuable. And I don't think that's the case for every community. So I think we're fortunate here to have that working relationship. It's not uncommon that we will collaborate on issues pertaining to police policies, even apart from our investigations. We were invited to be a part of a process last winter to take a look at the police department within at those policies pertaining to use of force. And they had some proposals, provided some feedback based on what their proposals were. And they graciously adopted some of our ideas into what the final product was in terms of those revisions. So that's just one example of the ongoing collaboration that we have. And I think it's a productive relationship at the end of the day, that these things don't have to be don't have to proceed in a coarse manner, right? We all have a job to do, and we certainly don't agree on everything. But I think at the end of the day, we all have our eye on the ball here, and I'm grateful to have a partner in the chief and his staff that recognize that.
We heard Iris Rowley in the previous segment say she hopes that the CCA works itself out of a job someday. I've only got a minute left for this question, but what would the conditions be for that to happen, do you think?
Well, I think that certainly is a great goal to have. I think at the end of the day, Article 28 calls for us to address root causes and to seek to prevent complaints. And that really is a key outcome of the investigations process, is that ultimately, we are either deterring things from happening or identifying patterns to prevent things from happening. And in the long run, what we all want to see, I think, is a reduction in these complaints and ultimately an elimination of the need for groups like CCA in our community. I think we're obviously not quite there yet, but certainly that is, I think, big picture, what the ideal outcome would be from these processes.
Gabe Davis is the executive director of the Citizen Complaint Authority. Gabe, thanks so much for the time you gave us. I hope we talk again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you, Michael.
The penultimate episode of the Brood 10 Cicada podcast is online today at WVXU.org. It looks like the cicadas are starting to fade, so catch up on the next to last episode of that 10-part series at WVXU.org. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. At WVXU.org, you can also find every episode we've ever done, so go listen at your leisure. I'm Michael Monks. We'll talk again tomorrow.